12. Maria didn't say anything for a while. "Don't you think my aunt's really beautiful?" Maria said, abruptly changing subjects.
"Yes, she's a very lovely person."
"Are you single?"
Nearly, I responded. Once that envelope arrived at the law office, it'd be completely.
"Would you like to go on a date with her?"
"That would be nice."
"She has big breasts, too."
I hadn't noticed.
"And they're really nicely shaped. We bathe together sometimes, so I know."
I looked at Maria's face again.
"Do you get along well with your aunt?" "We fight sometimes," she said.
"About what?"
"All kinds of things. When we have a difference of opinion, or when she makes me mad."
"You're an unusual girl," I said. "You're quite different from when you're in art class. I got the impression you were very quiet."
"In places where I don't want to talk, I don't," she said simply. "Am I talking too much? Would it be better if I stayed quiet?"
"No, not at all. I like talking. Feel free to talk as much as you like." Of course, I welcomed a lively conversation. I wasn't about to stay totally silent for nearly 2 hours and just paint.
"I can't help thinking about my breasts," Maria said after a while. "That's all I think about, pretty much. Is that weird?"
"Not particularly," I said. "You're at that age. When I was your age, all I thought about was my penis. Whether it was shaped funny or was too small, whether it was working wrong."
"What about now?"
"You're asking what I think about my penis now?"
"Yeah."
I thought about it. "I don't give it much thought. It's pretty ordinary, I guess, and hasn't given me any problems."
"Do women admire it?"
"Occasionally, there might be one who does, but that might just be flattery, like when people praise paintings." Maria pondered this for a while. Finally, she said,
"You may be a little strange."
"Really?"
"Normal men don't talk like that. Even my father doesn't say things like that to me."
"I doubt fathers in normal families want to talk about penises with their daughters," I said. All the while, my hand continued to move busily over the paper.
"At what age do nipples get bigger?" Maria asked.
"I'm not really sure. Since I'm a guy, I'd say it really depends on the person."
"Did you have a girlfriend when you were a kid?"
"I had my first girlfriend when I was 17. A girl in the same class in high school."
"What high school?"
I told her the name of a public high school in Toshima, in Tokyo. Outside of people who lived in Toshima, probably no one had ever heard of it.
"Did you like school?"
I shook my head. "Not particularly."
"Did you ever see that girlfriend's nipples?"
"Yeah," I said. "She showed them to me."
"How big were they?"
I remembered the girl's nipples. "They weren't especially small or big. Normal size, I guess."
"Did she pad her bra?"
I tried to recall the bra my girlfriend had worn back then. All I had was a very vague memory of it. What I did recall was how much trouble I had slipping my hand behind her and unhooking it. "No, I don't think she padded it."
"What's she doing now?"
What was she doing now? I don't know. I haven't seen her for a long time. I imagine she's married, maybe with some children.
"How come you don't see her?"
"The last time I saw her, she said she never wanted to see me again." Maria frowned.
"Was this because there was something wrong with you?"
"I guess," I said. Of course, the problem lay with me. No room for doubt there. Actually, I'd recently had two dreams about this high school girlfriend. In one dream, we were strolling along a river on a summer's evening. I tried to kiss her, but her long black hair formed a curtain in front of her face, and my lips couldn't touch hers. In the dream, she was still 17, but I had already turned 36, something I suddenly noticed. And that's when I woke up. It was such a vivid dream. I could still feel her hair on my lips. Before this, I hadn't thought about her for years. How much younger than you was your younger sister? Maria said, again suddenly changing topics.
3 years younger.
You said she died when she was 12?
That's right.
So that would make you 15 then?
Right, I was 15. I'd just started high school, and she'd just started junior high, just like you.
Now that I thought about it, Komi was now 24 years younger than me. Since she'd died, every year the age gap only increased between us.
I was 6 when my mother died, Maria said. She got stung by hornets when she was walking in the mountains nearby.
I'm very sorry, I said. She had an allergy to hornet stings. They took her by ambulance to the hospital, but she was already in shock and went into cardiac arrest.
Your aunt moved in with you after that?
Yeah, Maria said. She's my father's younger sister. I wish I'd had an older brother, a brother 3 years older.
I finished up the first Dasan and began a second. I wanted to draw her from several angles. This first day I planned to devote just to sketches.
Did you ever fight with your sister? She asked.
No, I don't recall ever fighting.
So you got along well?
I suppose so. I never considered whether we did or not.
What does nearly single mean? Maria asked, again shifting subjects.
I'll soon be officially divorced, I said. We're in the midst of handling all the paperwork, so that's why it's nearly.
She narrowed her eyes. I don't get divorce. Nobody I know has ever divorced.
I don't get it either. I mean, it's the first time I ever got divorced.
What does it feel like?
A bit bizarre, I guess. Like you're walking along as always, sure you're on the right path, when the path suddenly vanishes, and you're facing an empty space, no sense of direction, no clue where to go, and you just keep trudging along. That's what it feels like.
How long were you married?
About 6 years.
How old is your wife?
She's 3 years younger. Just a coincidence, but the same age difference as with my sister.
Do you think you wasted those 6 years?
I thought about it. No, I don't think so. I don't want to think it was all for nothing. We had a lot of good times, too.
Does your wife think so, too?
I shook my head. I don't know. I'd hope she would, of course.
You didn't ask her?
No. If I have a chance, maybe I will sometime.
Silence reigned between us for a while. I focused on the Dasan, and Maria Akikawa was lost in serious thought. Thoughts about the size of nipples, perhaps, or divorce, or hornets, or maybe something else entirely. Eyes narrowed, lips tight, both hands tightly holding her knees. She'd shifted into that mode, apparently, as I was capturing her earnest expression on the white page of my sketchbook. Every day, exactly at noon, I could hear a chime from down the mountain, ringing from some government office or maybe a school to announce the time. When I heard it now, I glanced at the clock and finished drawing. I'd managed to complete 3 Dasan during this first session, all of them pretty interesting compositions, each one hinting at something to come. Not bad for a day's work. Maria Akikawa had sat on the chair in the studio, posing for me, for over an hour and a half. For the first day, that was enough. For someone not used to it, especially an active, growing child, posing for a painting wasn't easy. Shoko Akikawa had put on black-framed glasses and was seated on the living room sofa, absorbed in reading her paperback. When I came in, she took off the glasses and stowed the paperback in her bag. The glasses made her look quite intellectual. "We're all finished for the day," I said. "If it's all right, could you come again the same day next week?" "Yes, of course," Shoko said. "It feels really nice to read here. Maybe because the sofa's so comfortable?"
"You don't mind?" I asked Maria. Maria nodded silently. "I don't mind," it meant.
In front of her aunt, she was totally changed and had become taciturn again. Maybe she didn't like when the three of us were together. They got into their blue Toyota Prius and drove away. I saw them off at the front door. Shoko, sunglasses on, reached a hand out the window and gave a few short waves goodbye. A small, pale hand. I raised my hand in reply. Maria tucked in her chin and stared straight ahead. Once the car had disappeared from view down the slope, I went back inside. The house seemed suddenly barren, like something that should be there wasn't anymore. An odd pair, I thought, as I stared at the teacups still on the table. There was something peculiar about them, but what exactly? I remembered Manshiki. Maybe I should have taken Maria out on the terrace so he could get a good look at her through his binoculars. But then I rethought that. Why did I have to go out of my way to do that, when he hadn't even asked me to? Other opportunities would present themselves. No need to rush. Probably. Chapter 31. Maybe a little too perfect. That night, I got a call from Manshiki. The clock showed that it was past 9. He apologized for calling so late. Something silly came up and I couldn't get free until now, he said. I'm not going to bed for a while, I said, so don't worry about the time. So how did things go today? Did it work out well? He asked. It did. I completed a few desan of Maria. The two of them will be coming over the same time next Sunday. I'm glad, Manshiki said. By the way, was the aunt favorably disposed toward you? Favorably disposed? What a strange way of putting it. I said, yes, she seems like a very nice woman. I don't know if favorably disposed is the right term, but she didn't seem particularly wary. I summed up what had taken place that morning. Manshiki listened with what seemed like bated breath, apparently trying to absorb as much detailed information as he could. Other than a couple of questions, he hardly said a word and just listened intently. What sort of clothes the two had on, how they had arrived, how they appeared, what they'd said, and how I'd gone about sketching Maria Akikawa. I told Manshiki all this piece by piece. I didn't, though, delve into Maria's obsession with the size of her breasts. That was best kept between us. It might be a little early then for me to show up next week, Manshiki asked me. It's up to you. I can't say I don't have a problem if you come over next week. On the other end of the line, Manshiki was silent. I'll have to think about it. It's kind of delicate. Take your time. It's going to take a while to finish the painting, and there should be plenty of opportunities. Next week or the week after that, either way is fine with me. I'd never seen Manshiki so hesitant before. Quickly decisive and never wavering, that was the Manshiki I knew. I was thinking of asking him if he'd been watching my house with his binoculars this morning, whether he'd been able to observe Maria and her aunt, but I thought better of it. As long as he didn't bring it up, it seemed smarter not to mention that topic, even if the place under surveillance was the house I was living in. Manshiki thanked me again. I'm really sorry to ask you to go to all this trouble for me. I said, I'm not doing anything for your sake. I'm simply doing a painting of Maria Akikawa. I'm painting it because I want to. I thought that's how we decided things were going to be, both the private and public reasons for it. So there's no reason for you to thank me. Still, I'm very grateful, Manshiki said quietly, in a lot of ways. I didn't really understand what he meant by a lot of ways, but didn't ask. It was getting late. We said a quick goodbye and hung up, but after I put the phone down, it suddenly occurred to me that Manshiki might be spending a long, sleepless night tonight. I could sense the tension in his voice. He probably had lots of things on his mind. Not much happened that week. The commendatore didn't make an appearance, and my girlfriend didn't get in touch. A very quiet week altogether. Autumn steadily deepened around me. The sky opened up, the air clear and crisp, the clouds like beautiful white brushstrokes. I often studied the three desan I'd done of Maria, the different poses, the different angles. I found them fascinating and suggestive. Though from the beginning I hadn't planned to choose one of them to use as the preliminary design for the painting, the point of doing those three sketches, as she herself had said, was so I could understand the totality of this girl, to internally assimilate her. I looked at those three desan over and over again, intently focusing, trying to construct a concrete picture of the girl in my mind. As I did this, I got the distinct sense of Maria Akikawa's figure and that of my sister getting mixed into one. Was this appropriate? I couldn't say. But the spirits of these two young girls, nearly the same age, were already somewhere, probably in some deep internal recesses I shouldn't access, blended and combined. I could no longer unravel those two intertwined spirits. That Thursday, I received a letter from my wife. This was the first time since I'd left home in March that she'd gotten in touch. My name and address and hers were written on the envelope in her familiar, beautiful, steady handwriting. She was still using my last name, I saw. Maybe it was more convenient somehow, until the divorce became official, to continue to use her husband's last name. I used scissors to neatly snip open the envelope. Inside was a postcard with a photo of a polar bear standing on top of an iceberg. On the card, she'd written a simple message thanking me for signing the divorce papers and mailing them back so quickly. "How are you? I'm managing to get by, nothing to report. I'm still living in the same place. Thank you for mailing back the papers so quickly. I appreciate it. I'll get in touch when there's been progress in the process. If there's anything you left at the house you need, please let me know. I'll send it to you. At any rate, I hope both our new lives work out. Yuzu." I reread the letter many times, straining to decipher the feelings hidden behind those lines, but I couldn't detect any implied emotion or intention. She just seemed to be transmitting the clearly stated message that the words conveyed. One other thing I didn't understand was why it had taken her so long to prepare the divorce papers. It's not that much trouble to get them ready, and she must have wanted to dissolve our relationship as fast as possible. Even so, half a year had passed since I'd left our house. What had she been doing all that time? What had been going through her mind? I gazed at the postcard with the polar bear, but couldn't read any intentions in that either. Why a polar bear from the North Pole? She probably just happened to have the polar bear card on hand and used it. Most likely that's the case, I figured. Or was she suggesting that my future was like that of the polar bear, stuck on a tiny iceberg, directionless, carried away by the whims of the current? No, that was reading too much into it. I tossed the card into the envelope and put it inside the top drawer of my desk. Once I shut the drawer, it felt like things had progressed one step forward, like with a click, the scale had moved one line up. Not that this was my doing. Someone, something had prepared this new stage in my stead, and I was simply going along with the program. I recalled how on Sunday I'd talked to Maria Akikawa about life after divorce. "Like you're walking along as always, sure you're on the right path. When the path suddenly vanishes, and you're facing an empty space, no sense of direction, no clue where to go, and you just keep trudging along. That's what it feels like. A directionless ocean current, a road to nowhere, it didn't matter much. They were both the same, just metaphors. I was experiencing the real thing and being swallowed up by reality. If I had that, who needs a metaphor? If I could, I wanted to write a letter to Yuzu to explain the situation I found myself in now. I didn't think I could write something vague like, I'm managing to get by, nothing to report. Far from it. My honest sense was there was too much to report. But if I started writing about every single thing that had happened to me since I started living here, it would spin out of control. The biggest problem was that I couldn't explain well to myself what was happening. At least I knew I couldn't find a consistent, logical context in which to explain it all. So I decided not to write back to Yuzu. If I did start writing, there were only two ways to go. Either explain everything that had taken place, ignoring logic and consistency, or write nothing. I chose the latter. In a sense, I really was the lonely polar bear left behind to drift on an iceberg. Not a single mailbox as far as the eye could see. A polar bear has no way to send a letter, now does he? I remember very well when Yuzu and I first met and started dating. On our first date, we had dinner, talked about all kinds of things, and she seemed to like me. She said I could see her again. From the first, our minds seemed to inexplicably click. Simply put, we seemed a good match. But it took some time before I actually became her lover. Yuzu had another man she'd been seeing for 2 years. Not that she was head over heels in love with him. He's really handsome, though a bit boring sometimes, she said. Very handsome, but boring. There was no one I knew like that, so I couldn't picture that type of person. What came to mind was a dish of food that looked delicious but ended up tasting bland. Would anyone be happy with that kind of food? I've always had a weakness for good-looking men, she said, as if making a confession. Whenever I meet a handsome man, it's like my brain goes out the window. I know that's a problem, but I can't do anything about it. I can't get over that. That might be my biggest weakness. A chronic disease, I said. She nodded. That could be an incurable disorder. A chronic disease. Not exactly great news for me, I said. Handsome features weren't my strongest selling point. She didn't deny that and just laughed happily. At least she didn't seem bored when we were together. She had a lot to say and laughed a lot. So I waited patiently for things to not work out between her and this handsome boyfriend. He wasn't merely good-looking, but had graduated from a top university and had a high-paying job at a top corporation. I bet he and Yuzu's father got along famously. All this time, she and I talked over all sorts of things, went to all sorts of places. We got to understand each other better. We kissed, held each other, but didn't have sex. Having a physical relationship with several partners at the same time wasn't her style. I'm a bit old-fashioned that way, she said. So all I could do was bide my time. This went on for about half a year. For me, it felt like eternity. Sometimes I just wanted to give up, but I managed to hang in there, convinced that someday soon she would be mine. And finally, she and her handsome boyfriend broke up. At least I think they broke up. She never said a word about it, so it was conjecture on my part. And she chose me, not much to look at, not much of a breadwinner, as her lover. Soon after, we decided to get married. I remember very well the first time we made love. We'd gone to stay at a small hot springs town in the country and spent our first night together there. Everything went really well. Almost perfect, you could even say. Maybe a little too perfect. Her skin was soft and pale and silky smooth. The somewhat slick hot mineral water of the hot springs bath, combined with the pale glow of the early autumn moonlight, may have contributed to the beauty and smoothness of her skin. I held her naked body for the first time, went inside her, she moaned quietly in my ear and dug her nails hard into my back. The autumn insects were in full chorus then, too. A cool mountain stream burbled in the background. I made a firm pledge to myself then. Never, ever let this woman go. This may have been the most sublime moment of my life up till then, finally making Yuzu mine. After I got the short letter from Yuzu, I thought about her for a long time. About when we'd first met, that autumn night when we first made love. About how my feelings for her had basically never changed from the first moment up to the present. Even now, I didn't want to lose her. That much was clear to me. I'd signed and sealed the divorce papers, but that didn't change things. No matter how I felt about it, though, the fact was that she'd suddenly left me. Gone far away, probably very far away, where even the most powerful binoculars couldn't afford me a glimpse of her. Somewhere, while I was oblivious to it, she must have found a new, handsome lover. As always, her brain went out the window. I should have picked up on this when she started refusing to sleep with me. Having a physical relationship with several partners at the same time wasn't her style. If only I'd thought about it, I soon would have realized that. A chronic disease, I thought. A serious illness with no prospects for a cure. A physical inclination that doesn't respond to reason. That night, a rainy Thursday night, I had a long, dark dream. In that small seaside town in Miyagi, I was driving the white Subaru Forester. It was now my car. I had on an old black leather jacket and a black golf cap with a Yanexa logo. I was tall, deeply suntanned, my salt and pepper hair short and stiff. In other words, I was the man with the white Subaru Forester. I was stealthily following my wife in the small car, a red Peugeot 205, the man she was having an affair with was driving. We were on the highway that ran along the coast. I saw the two of them go into a tacky love hotel on the outskirts of town. The next day, I came up behind my wife and strangled her with a narrow white belt from a bathrobe. I was used to physical labor and had powerful arms, and as I strangled her with all my might, I screamed something. I couldn't hear what I'd yelled out, a meaningless roar of pure rage, a horrific rage I'd never experienced before and had control over my mind and body. White spittle flew as I roared out. As she desperately gasped for air, I saw my wife's temples convulse a little. I saw her pink tongue ball up and twist inside her mouth. Blue veins rose up on her skin like an invisible ink map. I smelled my own sweat. An unpleasant smell I'd never smelled before rose up from my body like steam from a hot springs. It reminded me of the stink of some hairy beast. "Don't you dare paint me," I ordered myself. I violently thrust out an index finger at myself in the mirror on the wall. "Don't paint me anymore!" And there I snapped awake. I knew now what had frightened me most in bed in that love hotel in the seaside town. Deep in my heart, I feared that in the last instant, I really would have strangled to death that girl, the young girl whose name I didn't even know. "You can just pretend," she said, "but it might not have ended with just that. It might not have ended with just pretend, and the reason for that lay inside me. I wish I could understand myself, too, but it's not easy." This is what I'd told Maria Akikawa. I remembered this as I wiped the sweat away with a towel. The rain let up on Friday morning, the sky turning beautifully sunny. I hadn't slept well, felt worked up, and to calm down, went for an hour's walk around the neighborhood later in the morning. I went into the woods, walked behind the little shrine, and checked out the hole for the first time in a long while. It was November now, and the wind was much colder than before. The ground was covered with damp fallen leaves. The hole was, as before, tightly covered over with several boards. Many colored leaves had piled up on the boards, and there were several heavy stones to hold the boards down. But the way the stones were lined up seemed a little different from when I'd last seen them. Nearly the same, yet ever so slightly positioned differently. I didn't worry about it. There wouldn't be anyone else other than Menshiki and me who would tramp all the way out here. I pulled away one of the boards and peered down inside, but no one was there. The ladder was leaned up against the wall like before. Like always, that dark stone-lined chamber lay there, deep and silent, at my feet. I put the board back on top and placed the stone back where it had been. It didn't bother me either that the Commendatore hadn't appeared for a good 2 weeks. Like he said, an idea has a lot of business to attend to, business that transcended time and space. The following Sunday finally came. A lot of things happened that day. It turned out to be a very hectic day. Chapter 32. His skills were in great demand. Another prisoner approached us as we talked. He was a professional painter from Warsaw, a man of medium height with a hawk nose and a very black mustache on his fair-skinned face. His distinctive figure stood out from afar, and his professional status, his skills were in great demand in the camp, was evident. He was certainly no one's non-entity. He often talked to me at length about his work. I do color paintings, portraits, for the Germans. They bring me photos of their relatives, wives, mothers, and children. Everyone wants to have pictures of their closest kin. The SS described their families to me with emotion and love, the color of their eyes, their hair. I produce family portraits from amateurish, blurry black and white photos. Believe me, I would rather paint black and white pictures of the children in the piles of corpses in the lazarette than the Germans' families. Give them pictures of the people they murdered. Let them take them home and hang them on the wall, the sons of bitches. The artist was especially distraught on this occasion. Samuel Willenberg, Revolt in Treblinka, page 96. Copyright by Samuel Willenberg, 1984. Lazarette was another name for the execution facility in the Treblinka concentration camp. Part 2. The Shifting Metaphor. Chapter 33. I like things I can see as much as things I can't. Sunday was another fine, clear day. No wind to speak of, and the fall colors in the valley sparkling in the sunlight. Small white-breasted birds hopped from one branch to the next, deftly pecking the red berries. I sat on the terrace, soaking it all in. Nature grants its beauty to us all, drawing no line between rich and poor. Like time. No, scratch that. Time could be a different story. Money may help us buy a little extra of that. The bright blue Toyota Prius rolled up the slope to my door at 10 on the dot. Shoko Akikawa was decked out in a thin beige turtleneck and snug-fitting slacks of pale green. Around her neck, a modest gold chain gave off a muted glow. As on her past visit, her hair was perfectly done. When it swayed, I could catch a glimpse of the lovely line of her neck. Today, though, she had a leather bag, not a purse, slung over her shoulder. She wore brown loafers. It was a casual outfit, yet she had clearly spent time choosing each piece. And the swell of her breasts was very attractive, too. I had the inside scoop from her niece that no padding was involved. I felt quite drawn to those breasts, in a purely aesthetic way, of course. Mario was dressed in straight-cut faded blue jeans and white Converse sneakers, a 180-degree turnaround from the formality of her first visit. Her jeans had holes in them, strategically placed, of course. She had on the sort of plaid shirt a lumberjack might wear in the woods, with a thin gray windbreaker draped over her shoulders. Underneath the shirt, as before, her chest was flat. And, just as before, she had a sour expression on her face, like a cat whose dish has been whisked away halfway through its meal. Just as I'd done the previous week, I went into the kitchen, made a pot of tea, and brought it to the living room. Then I showed them the three desan I had made. Shoko seemed to like them. "They're all so full of life," she exclaimed. "So much more like Maria than photographs." "Can I keep them?" Maria asked.
"Sure," I answered, "once your portrait is finished. I may need them until then."
Her aunt looked worried.
"Really? Aren't you being too..."
"Not at all," I said. "They're of no use to me once the portrait's done."
"Will you use one of these desan for your underdrawing?" Maria asked.
"No," I shook my head. "I did them just to get a three-dimensional feel for who you are. The you who I put on canvas will be altogether different."
"Can you tell what that's going to look like?"
"No, not yet. The two of us still have to figure that one out."
"Figure out how I look three-dimensionally?" Maria asked.
"That's right. A painting is a flat surface, but it still has to have three dimensions. Do you follow me?"
Maria frowned. I guessed she might somehow associate the word three-dimensional with her flat chest. In fact, she shot a glance at the curves beneath her aunt's thin sweater before looking at me.
"How can somebody learn to draw this well?" Maria asked.
"You mean like these desan?" She nodded.
"Yeah, like desan, croquis, things like that."
"It's all practice. The more you practice, the better you get."
"I think there are a lot of people," she said, "who don't improve no matter how much they practice."
She sure hit that one on the head. I had attended art school, but loads of my classmates couldn't paint their way out of a paper bag. However we thrash about, we are all thrown in one direction or another by our natural talent, or lack of it. That's a basic truth we all have to learn to live with.
"Fair enough, but you still have to practice. If you don't, any gifts or talents you do have won't emerge where people can see them."
Shoko gave an emphatic nod. Maria looked dubious.
"You want to learn to paint well, correct?"
I asked her. Maria nodded.
"I like things I can see as much as things I can't," she said.
I looked in her eyes. A light was shining there. I wasn't sure I understood exactly what she meant, but that inner light was drawing me in.
"What a strange thing to say," Shoko said, "like you were speaking in riddles."
Maria didn't respond, just studied her hands. When she did look up a short while later, the light was gone. It had only been there a moment. Maria and I went to the studio. Shoko had already pulled out the same thick paperback, at least it looked identical to the one she had brought the previous week, and settled down on the sofa to read. She seemed totally engrossed in the book. I was even more curious than before as to what it might be, but I didn't ask. Maria and I sat across from each other about 6 feet apart, just as we had the last time. The only difference was that now I had an easel and canvas in front of me. No paints or brush, though. My hands were empty. My eyes hopped back and forth, from Maria to the canvas to Maria again. All the while, the question of how best to portray her three-dimensionally was running through my mind. I needed a story of some sort to work from. It wasn't enough to just look at the person I happened to be painting. Nothing good could result from that. The portrait might be a passable likeness, but no more. To turn out a true portrait, I had to discover the story that must be painted. Only that could get the ball rolling. We sat there for some time, me on the stool, Maria on a straight-backed chair, as I studied her face. She stared back at me without blinking, never averting her eyes. She didn't look defiant so much as ready to stand her ground. Her pretty, almost doll-like appearance sent people the wrong signal. At her core, she had a strong sense of herself and her own unshakable way of doing things. Once she'd drawn a straight line, good luck getting her to bend it. There was something in Maria's eyes that reminded me of Manshiki, though I had to look closely to see it. I had felt the similarity before, but it still surprised me. Their gaze had a strange radiance. A frozen flame was the phrase that leapt to mind. That flame had warmth, but at the same time, it was cool and collected, like a rare jewel whose glow came from deep within. That light expressed naked yearning when projected outside. Focused inward, it strove for completion. These two sides were equally strong and at perpetual war with each other. Did Manshiki's revelation that his blood might be running through Maria's veins influence me? Perhaps that had led me to unconsciously link the two of them together. Whatever the case, I had to transfer that glow in her eyes to the canvas to capture how special it was. The core element in her expression, the thing that cut through her modulated exterior. Yet I still hadn't located the context that made such a transfer possible. If I failed, that warm light would come across as an icy jewel, nothing more. Where was the heat coming from? And where was it headed? I had to find out. I sat there for 15 minutes, gazing at her face, then at the canvas, and back again, before finally giving up. I pushed the easel aside and took a few slow, deep breaths. "Let's talk," I said.
Sure,
she answered. "What do you want to talk about?" "I want to know more about you, if that's okay."
"Like,
well, what sort of person is your father?" Maria gave a small smirk. "I don't know him very well."
"You don't talk?"
"We hardly see each other."
"Because he's busy with work?"
"I don't know anything about his work," Maria said. "I don't think he cares about me that much."
"Doesn't care?"
"That's why he handed me over to my aunt to raise."
I took a pass on that one.
"How about your mother? Can you remember her? You were 6 when she passed away, right?" "I can only remember her in patches."
"What do you mean, in patches?"
"My mom disappeared all of a sudden. I was too little to understand what dying meant, so I didn't really know what had happened. She was there, and then she just wasn't. Like smoke."
Maria was quiet for a moment.
"It happened so quickly, and I couldn't understand the reason," she said at last. "That's why I can't remember much about that part of my life, like right before and after her death."
"You must have been pretty confused."
"It's like there's this high wall that divides when she was with me and when she was gone. I can't connect the two parts together."
She chewed her lip for a moment.
"Do you get what I mean?"
"I think so," I said. "My sister died when she was 12. I told you that before, right?"
Maria nodded. "She was born with a defective valve in her heart. She had a big operation and everything was supposed to be okay, but for some reason, there was still a problem. So she lived with a time bomb ticking inside her body. As a result, everyone in our family was more or less prepared for the worst. Her death didn't hit us like a bolt from the blue, like when your mother was stung by hornets."
"A bolt?"
"A bolt from the blue," I said. "A bolt of lightning that strikes from a cloudless sky. Something sudden and unexpected."
"A bolt from the blue," she said.
"What characters is it written with?"
"The blue is written with characters for blue sky. Bolt is really complicated. I can't write it myself. In fact, I've never written it. If you're curious, you should look it up in a dictionary when you get back home." A bolt from the blue, she repeated.
She seemed to be storing the phrase in her mental filing cabinet. At any rate, I went on, we all had an idea what might happen. When it actually did, though, when she had a sudden heart attack and died all in one day, our preparations didn't make a bit of difference. Her death paralyzed me. And not just me, my whole family.
Did something change inside you after that?
Yes, completely, both inside and outside. Time didn't pass as it had before. It flowed differently. And, like you said, I had a problem connecting how things were before her death with the way they were after.
Maria stared at me without speaking for a full 10 seconds.
Your sister meant a lot to you, didn't she? She said at last.
Yes, I nodded.
She did.
Maria studied her lap for a moment.
It's because my memory is blocked, she said, looking up, that I have trouble recalling my mom, the kind of person she was, her face, the things she said to me. My dad doesn't talk much about her either.
All I knew about Maria's mother was the blow-by-blow account Manshiki had given me of the last time they had had sex. It had been on his office couch, the moment of Maria's conception, perhaps, and it was violent. Not a big help at the moment.
You must remember something, even if it's not much. After all, you lived with her till you were 6.
Just the smell.
The smell of her body?
No, the smell of rain.
Rain?
It was raining then, so hard I could hear the drops hit the ground. But my mother was walking outside without an umbrella, so we walked through the rain together holding hands. I think it was summer.
A summer shower then?
I guess so. The pavement was hot from the sun, so it gave off that smell. That's what I remember. We were high in the mountains on some kind of observation deck, and my mother was singing a song.
What kind of song?
I can't remember the melody, but I do remember some of the words. They were like, the sun's shining on a big green field across the river, but it's been raining on this side for so long. Have you ever heard a song like that?
It didn't ring a bell.
No, I replied. I don't think so.
Maria gave a little shrug.
I've asked different people, but no one knows it. I wonder why. Do you think maybe I made it up in my head?
Maybe she invented it there on the spot. For you.
Maria looked up at me and smiled. I never thought about it like that before. If that's true, it's pretty cool.
I think it was the first time I'd seen her smile.
It was as if a ray of sunlight had shot through a crack in an overcast sky to illuminate one special spot. It was that kind of smile.
Could you recognize the place if you went there again? I asked. Back to that same observation deck in the mountains?
Maybe, Maria said. I'm not sure, but maybe.
I think it's pretty cool that you carry that scene inside you.
Maria just nodded. After that, we just sat back and listened to the birds chirping. The autumn sky outside the window was perfectly clear, not a wisp of cloud anywhere. We were each in our own inner world, pursuing our own random thoughts. It was Maria who broke the silence. Why's that painting facing the wrong way? She asked. She was pointing at my oil painting, to be more precise, my attempted painting, of the man with the white Subaru Forester. The canvas was sitting on the floor, turned to the wall so that I wouldn't have to look at it. I'm trying to paint a certain man. It's a work in progress, but it's not progressing right now.
Can I see it?
Sure, I've just started it, though. I have a long way to go. I turned the canvas around and placed it on the easel. Maria got up from her chair, walked over, and stood before it with her arms folded. The sharp gleam in her eyes had returned. Her lips were set in a straight line.
I had used 3 colors, red, green, and black, but still hadn't given the man a distinct shape. My initial charcoal sketch was now totally obscured. He refused to be fleshed out any further, to have more color added to his form. But I knew he was there. I had grasped the essence of who he was. He was like a fish caught in a net. I had been trying to pull him out of the depths, and he was fighting me at every turn. At that point in our tug of war, I had set the painting aside. "This is where you stop?" Maria asked. "That's right. I couldn't find a way to push it past this stage." "It looks pretty finished to me," she murmured. I stood next to her and looked at the painting again from her angle. Could she really see the man lurking there in the darkness?
"You mean I don't need to add anything more?" I asked.
"Yeah, I think you should just leave it like this." I swallowed. She was echoing what the man with the white Subaru Forester had said almost word for word. "Leave the painting alone. Don't touch it again."
"Why do you think that?" I pressed.
Maria didn't answer right away. Instead, she studied the painting some more. She unfolded her arms and pressed her hands to her cheeks, as if they were hot, and she was trying to cool them. "This painting is more than powerful enough as it is," she said at last.
"More than powerful enough?"
"I think so."
"You mean a not-so-good kind of power?"
Maria didn't answer. Her hands were still pressed to her cheeks. "Do you know the man in the painting well?"
I shook my head. "No, to tell the truth, he's a complete stranger. I ran across him a while back, in a faraway town when I was on a long trip. We never talked, so I don't know his name."
"I can't tell if the power is good or not. Maybe it could be either good or bad, depending on the situation. You know, like the way we see things changes depending on where we're standing."
"And you don't think I should let that power come to the surface, right?"
She looked me in the eye. "Suppose you did and it turned out to be a not-so-good thing. What would you do? What if it tried to grab you?" She was right. If it turned out to be a not-so-good thing, or indeed an evil thing, and it reached for me, what would I do then? I took the canvas from the easel and set it back down on the floor, facing the wall. The moment its surface was hidden, the tension in the studio released its grip. It was a tangible sensation. Perhaps I should pack it up and shut it away in the attic, I thought. Just as Tomohiko Amada had stashed Killing Commendatore there, to make sure no one could see it.
"All right, so then what do you think of that painting?" I asked, pointing to Killing Commendatore hanging on the wall.
"I like it," Maria said immediately. "Who did it?"
"It was painted by Tomohiko Amada, the man who owns this house."
"It's calling out to me, like a caged bird crying to be set free. That's the feeling I get."
I looked at her. "Bird? What kind of bird?"
"I don't know what kind of bird, or what kind of cage, or what they look like. It's just my feeling. I think maybe this painting's a little too difficult for me."
"You're not the only one. It's too difficult for me, too. But I'm sure you're right. There is a cry in this painting, a plea that the artist desperately wanted people to hear. I react the same way you do, but for the life of me, I can't figure out what that plea is."
"Someone is murdering someone else, out of passion."
"Exactly. The young man has plunged a knife into the older man's chest exactly as he planned. The man being murdered can't believe what's happening. The others are in total shock at what's taking place before their eyes."
"Can there be a proper murder?"
I thought for a moment. "I'm not sure. It depends how you define proper and improper. Many people regard the death penalty as a proper form of murder. Or assassination," I thought.
Maria took a moment to respond.
It's funny. A man's being killed and his blood is flying all over the place. But it's not depressing. It's like the painting is trying to take me someplace else. Someplace where things like proper and improper don't matter.
I didn't pick up a brush that day. Instead, Maria and I sat there in the bright studio talking about whatever crossed our minds. I kept a close eye on her, though, filing each expression and mannerism away in my mind. That stock of memories would become the flesh and blood of the portrait I wanted to paint.
You didn't draw anything today, Maria commented.
There are days like this, I said. Time steals some things, but it gives us back others. Making time our ally is an important part of our work.
Maria said nothing, just studied my eyes, as if she was peering into a house, her face pressed against the window. She was contemplating the meaning of time.
When the chimes rang as always at noon, Maria and I moved from the studio to the living room. Shoko Akikawa was sitting on the sofa, wearing her black-rimmed glasses, reading her paperback. She was so deep in the book it was hard to tell if she was breathing.
What are you reading? I asked, unable to bear the suspense any longer.
If I told you what it was, she said with a smile, marking her spot and closing the book, it would jinx it. For some reason, every time I tell someone what I'm reading, I'm unable to finish. Something unexpected happens and I have to break off partway through. It's strange, but it's true. So I've made it my policy not to reveal the title to anyone. I'd love to tell you about the book once I'm done, though.
No worries. I'm quite happy to wait until you're finished. I could see how much you're enjoying it, so I got curious.
It's a fascinating book. Once I get into it, I can't stop. That's why I've decided to read it only when I'm here. This way, 2 hours pass before I know it.
My aunt reads tons of books, Maria chimed in.
I don't have that much to do these days, her aunt said. So books are how I get by.
Do you have a job? I asked.
She removed her glasses and gently massaged the crease between her eyebrows.
I volunteer at our local library once a week. I used to work at a private medical college in Tokyo. I was secretary to the president there, but I gave it up when I moved here.
That was when Maria's mother passed away, wasn't it?
At the time, I thought it would just be temporary, that I would stay only until things got sorted out. But once I started living with Maria, it became hard to leave, so I've been here ever since. Of course, if my brother remarried, I would move back to the city.
I'd go with you if that happened, Maria said.
Shoko smiled politely, but didn't say anything.
Why don't you stay for lunch? I asked the two of them. I can whip up a pasta and salad in no time.
Shoko hesitated, as I knew she would, but Maria seemed excited by the idea.
Why not? She told her aunt. Dad isn't home.
It's really no problem, I said. I've got lots of sauce already made, so it's no more trouble to cook for three than for one.
Are you sure? Shoko said, looking doubtful.
Of course. Please do stay. I eat alone all the time. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. I'd like to share a meal with others for a change.
Maria looked at her aunt.
Well, in that case, we'll take you up on your kind invitation, Shoko said.
You're quite sure we're not imposing?
Not at all, I said. Please make yourself at home.
The three of us moved to the dining area. They sat at the table while I prepared the meal. I set the water to boil, warmed the asparagus and bacon sauce in a pan, and threw together a quick salad of lettuce, tomato, onion, and green peppers. When the water boiled, I tossed in the pasta and diced some parsley while it cooked. I took the iced tea from the fridge and filled 3 glasses. Maria and her aunt watched me bustle about as if witnessing a rare and strange event. Shoko asked if there was something she could do.
No, I replied. She should just relax. I had everything under control.
You seem so at home in the kitchen,
she said, impressed. That's because I do this every day.
I don't mind cooking at all. In fact, I've always liked working with my hands,